Coming up on Life is a Festival.
I'm very in touch with my feminine. I don't have that problem, you know? So I certainly am not rejecting my feminine attributes. I'm just maybe, you know, hoping to cultivate what I'm naturally predisposed to be, which is more masculine. And you know, in fact, in many ways, I'm learning to be a protector, be a little bit dangerous so that I can be a protector, because the world is dangerous. And not just for women in my lives, but also for my own feminine. I want to protect myself. Yeah. I realized that I was exploiting the parts of me that were feminine for like wealth and fame and status, you know, my creativity, my ability to, you know, be in touch with the magic of creation itself. And now as a more divine masculine protector, I'm like, fuck that. I'm not going to do that to myself anymore.
My name is Eamon Armstrong, and this is Life is a Festival. This podcast is a celebration of thinkers and leaders who live their lives with the open-hearted, experimental joy of a festival. Each week, we converse in complete openness, in an ongoing quest to find those boundaries in our being and melt them into lofty horizons. Life is a festival, only to the wise. My fellow travelers, welcome back to Life is a Festival. First of all, let me apologize for the lack of Life is a Festival episodes recently. I am now doing my podcasts in person, and like the professional I am, I had some audio issues. So we're back, and I am so thrilled to offer today's conversation. So today I'm speaking with Adrian Grenier, and I first experienced Adrian, as many of us did, as the boy prince Vincent Chase in the HBO series Entourage. However, I met him later at Burning Man, and what I saw in his eyes in that brief meeting at a masculinity workshop was a man going through a profound change, and that is the subject of today's podcast. So today on the show, we are going to look at Adrian's life through an archetypal lens, from the puer eternus, which is the boy who won't grow up, through to the four mature masculine archetypes as delineated in the book King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, which if you've been a fan of the show, you know I reference quite a bit. We definitely talk about his time on Entourage and the experience of how life imitated art in his own life. And then we get into his own trail of ashes, the portal to his maturation. And he shares some important tools that he used during that time, specifically things like embodiment. Finally, we discuss his new community project, which is outside of Austin, Texas, and it's named Kintsugi, which is a term for the Japanese art of fixing broken pottery with gold. So Adrian, as you probably already know, is an actor. He is also a director, a producer, a musician, an environmentalist, and now a rancher. He's best known for his role as Vincent Chase. He's also appeared in films such as Drive Me Crazy and The Devil Wears Prada, and he serves as a United Nations Environmental Goodwill Ambassador. And a little disclaimer before we begin. Discussions of gender are incredibly nuanced, especially now. There's no one-size-fits-all way of understanding gender polarities both within ourselves and in the world. So we endeavor to explore this conversation through our own experiences as male-identified people in this world and patterns that we have seen. So there may be times on the episode that you hear us speak and think, no, this is not me, this is totally wrong. And that is very true and very fair. But hopefully, no matter whether you identify as a man or a woman or any gorgeous constellation of gender expression, it is my hope that you get something meaningful out of today's conversation. Or at the very least, enjoy the incredibly charming Adrian Grenier. And so now, here is our conversation. Adrian, welcome to Life is a Festival. It's a pleasure to have you here.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for coming to me.
You know, it's such an incredible relief to be doing interviews in person again.
because it's just a different experience of physically being with someone.
Totally.
And getting to feel them a little bit. So we had some time yesterday where we felt, you know, some alignment in some of our journeys. And so now that I sit down with you and I'm in your space, in your beautiful ranch outside of Austin, Texas, and I can feel to some degree, to some limited degree, that your life force is pushing in a really interesting way. And so for me, as I've been thinking about the kind of conversation I want to have with you, I can feel you. I can just feel you. And so for me, a great conversation is like, how can this conversation be part of that life force moving forward? Like, what is the edge of your exploration right now? And how can we bring that into a conversation about your life and about how people who are listening to this podcast might imagine their own lives, particularly, I think, in our common interest in terms of young men?
Yes. I'm game.
So I was listening to you on a podcast in preparation for this, and you said something that was really interesting because it's something that I've felt in my own life, which is that you lived your life, particularly your youngest years, with this desire of a kind of forced memoir, that that you were living in such a way that you could have some epic shit to write about. And that resonated with me a lot because, and I think for many people in our culture, like we want to live an epic story. And then we have experiences to try to create that epic story. And we can get very lost in that space. Mm. And it's a very, it can ultimately be a pretty like myopic, self-focused place to be constructing this epic story of thresholds we cross and heroic feats and that sort of thing. And so when you talked about living a forced memoir, that resonated a lot for me. And I imagine that that what that memoir would look like has changed. Is there still an element in your life now of kind of like, what is my story? Or has that shed for you?
Yeah, I think that projecting visions, ideas of self, you know, what you want, you know, desire, you know, constructing an idea is part of the creative process. And then to go through the motions before, you know, fake it till you make it until you become the thing is a natural way of becoming. It's how we become, right? And then once we've started, once we've become good at that thing, once we become second nature, then it is identity, then it is who you are. And so I think that it's important to acknowledge and appreciate that process. A lot of times, you know, we get confused somewhere in the mix in that process because the projection is just an idea, right? So it feels fake to us or it feels phony. Or maybe you get lost only in the grand vision without remembering that you're actually here and now in this present moment as well. So we get to play, I think, as human beings with consciousness that expands beyond the moment to the future. And also we have quite an ability to have memories as well and to retain and reflect on past experiences or hold on to past moments. But we get to play in those realms. And I guess there was a time in which, for me, it was not just that I was living for my memoirs and I wanted my memoirs to be, you know, the most, I guess, what book was I living for is the issue. It's like, what was the grand vision? And I didn't have that. For me, it was just the most sensational, extreme, impulsive, destructive, death-defying experiences, ecstatic, indulgent experiences I could possibly have. And that was what the story I was cultivating was.
Were there any books that you were like, that were kind of part of your blueprint? Like maybe like a Hunter S. Thompson?
Oh,
was there
yeah.
anything I mean, where you're like, okay, I'm in the Hemingway thread?
Well, definitely stuck in that adolescent stage. You know, you realize you can, you know, you're 12, 13, you're starting to like pretend like you're your own man now, and you go out and you start doing stupid things. and taking risks and hanging out with the guys and daring each other to do things. And there's something really comforting about having that camaraderie and you know, the friendship. But you end up like encouraging each other to do really destructive things. And that's, I guess, natural, but that's the adolescent stage in which you're pushing boundaries. You're getting to know yourself and your own limitations and pushing those edges, feeling your weight in the world, feeling, you know, taking up space. And then there's, you know, fuckload of testosterone coursing through your body. So you're, you know, you got to put it somewhere. And then, of course, then you're influenced by, you know, Hunter S. Thompson and like, you know, taking psychedelics and seeing what that adventure is like and taking those kinds of risks and beatniks and, you know, getting on a motorcycle and driving cross country and like, you know, living off, you know, stolen bread, you know, that was like super romantic. And to me, that was living. And those were great books that inspired me. And I wanted to be living that life so that I could write a book like that, or so that I could be seen as the cool rebel who, you know, did all those wow, incredible things. And I guess I never really evolved past that. That's, you know, maybe part of the issue is I kept getting away with, you know, more and more extreme things and rewarded for it at you know, at that. And so it just kept confirming that I was on the right path. But there was, you know, something that I was, I think, missing. And a layer, a deeper layer. And I was still in the projection state. I wasn't really quite in my body and in the present moment and really experiencing, you know, the negative, destructive nature of my lifestyle.
Adrian, I love how quickly we've gotten right into the essence of what I'm excited to explore today with you.
Slow me down. Sorry.
No. This is perfect. We'll, you know, all the different pieces will come along for the ride. But this idea of the boy who won't grow up, also called the Puritanus, mm-hmm. We say Peter Pan complex in my hometown of San Francisco.
The Puritanus, there's a book written by a Jungian, like a student of Jung, a Jungian psychologist. And I think it was a woman who wrote it. She did a psychological case study of the author of The Little Prince.
Oh.
And you got to check it out.
Oh, yeah. I think this sounds familiar to me, because The Little Prince is quite an iconic figure in this,
totally.
In this way.
Yeah. Well, I read it and I was in my mid-20s maybe. I read it and I was like, oh, yeah, that's totally me.
Like you were proud of it?
I was like, yeah, that's totally me. And then I did nothing about it. It was just like, oh, yeah, that's me. And then I kept going.
So I feel like you have an extra mythic weight on your relationship to this archetype, because you were, at a certain point, the icon of the boy who won't grow up in the show Entourage.
Yep.
I mean, your character was... And I remember, like, I was in college watching that show, and yeah. I was exactly at the age where I was like, well, that's what you want to be.
Yeah, totally.
Like, that's what you aspire to be. Like, all of the glamour and the glitz and the ease with women, like, that energy.
Hell yeah.
And so I imagine that with the journey you've been on, especially over the past couple of years, there must be, like, an added weight, not a debt, not a guilt, not something like that, but, like, an extra kind of mythic element to you moving through that archetype. Do you feel that? Do you feel kind of like a responsibility to move past that archetype and maybe even show the world or show your community, show society how to make that transition?
Yes. Yes. I mean, how perfect is the universe? The universe is perfectly unfolding. And and once you start to realize that and see how magnificently, absolutely perfect it is, it's really a treat. It's like, oh, wow, my life is the exact formulation and, you know, manifestation of all the things that have come to make me who I am, and then what I represent in the world, and then all of my decisions that were actually reflecting all of the karmic realities that I was born into, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And whoa, yeah, I mean, the fact that I ended up as... an only child of a single mom with, you know, broken home, no father, no like strong masculine role models. And then I grew up, and when I was 20, I made a documentary about finding my father.
I didn't know that. You know, what was the documentary called?
Shot in the Dark. So there it is, like plot point number one. It's like, did I have a choice? No, I went out and I made a film about my father, found him. And the premise of the film was, I don't need to care about having a father. I don't need a father.
Ooh.
Yeah, that was like...
Has that film aged well for you?
Well, fuck, man. Like, I missed so much at 20. Like, I need to make the sequel because it's just... There's, like, so much that I... Yeah, you know, I was telling the story from where I was in life, you know? And, yeah, I mean, literally, I don't need a father. And in really indulging this very relativistic postmodern perspective, you know? And in fact, I really am proud of the ending of it. I'll give it away because no one's seen the movie anyway. This, go check it out if we'll
put it in the show notes.
Yeah, please do, because you know I'm proud of it. But I was definitely young at the time. It's very scrappy, by the way. Just FYI, it looks like a student. Well, it was just shot on video, so I just grabbed a camera and I just started filming. So it's really lo-fi, but like a lot of heart and. Great storytelling, I think. Anyway, check it out. But the end of the movie, there's two endings. There's one, and God bless my father for being willing and open to participate with me. Because imagine like your estranged son comes back after 20 years. You know, it must be a little unnerving. Like, what's he up to?
He's got a camera.
And he's got a camera and a crew and like, yeah, right. So, but God bless him. He was willing to go there and he was open to meeting me and being interviewed and being filmed. So I really respect and appreciate him for doing that. But at the end, we had two endings. One ending was the like fantasy of what it means, like what when you, the fantasy of the reunion of the father where he's so happy to see you and he's sorry for all the things and he loves you and you live happily ever after.
And it heals everything and because he says the right magic words
exactly.
And then all the pain goes away.
Right. And the music swells and everybody's crying and it's just beautiful. But then the dark ending is, you know, he's even more of an asshole. He's like the archetypical, like deadbeat dad, jerk, you know, destructive, masculine. And we played both of those roles out together. So he got to play both of those endings. And again, like you're talking about the projection, like the play is the thing, right? What are you creating in your mind as the... What's the projection you're trying to embody? And we do that all the time. We tell ourselves stories and then we live them out. And so at the time I was sort of wrestling with what is my story? What is the ending to the story? We get to actually play out either the extreme positive version or the extreme negative version. But really what real life is neither. It's the complexity of the film that, you know, was shot in the dark.
Well, and because real life doesn't have an ending in that sense.
That's,
I mean,
right.
you die at a certain point,
yeah.
And who knows what kind of an ending that may or may not be,
yeah.
But the threads of your life continue onward. So this idea that, okay, I'm going to reconcile with my father, he's going to say the right thing,
mm-hmm.
And that is going to fundamentally change me, and then I'll be at some sort of end point where like, well, then I'll just be like a normal mm-hmm. person who didn't get hurt. But it's mm-hmm. like there aren't normal people who didn't get hurt.
No.
Those people don't exist.
Yeah,
we're all sort
yeah.
of fumbling through with our wounds. And so the idea of this process is, I think that's where you find some peace, is to be like, oh, okay, well, you did that film with him at 20. Is he alive now?
He is, yeah.
And
yeah.
Do you have a relationship with him today?
You know, not so much. In fact, I had to make a distinct step away from him when I was going through my recent journey into adulthood. Because I found myself repeating too many of the patterns that he bequeathed me.
In the relationship with him or in other relationships in your life?
Particularly in the relationships with him. I found myself, you know, I want to be kind. I don't want to be, you know, too disparaging. But I just, you know, I found that I was starting to become sort of passive, and I was placating and just indulging experiences with my father that I just was uncomfortable with, just because I felt like I had to. And I realized that as I was growing up, I needed to start making more discerning choices about who I hung out with, how I showed up, how honest I was about the relationship, and be willing to say no in my life. And so I was practicing on some level, and I was saying, no, I don't want this relationship. It's not serving me right now. And I need men in my life who are going to embody and model a different energy. And my dad wasn't doing that. So I had to step away from that relationship and seek male relationships that were, I think, more teaching me things that I needed to learn.
Yeah, it's interesting in the king, warrior, magician, lover framework, which is mythopoetic men's movement, and we spoke about it briefly yesterday. The archetype of the warrior has an access through anger, and that anger, when held appropriately, is what is used to create boundaries. And I think for those of us who were raised with a bad expression of anger or no positive male expression at all, boundaries are very hard for us. And so it's interesting that, you know, you needing to express boundaries with your actual father, the person who was not present to teach you how to express boundaries, yeah, that must have been somewhat of an alchemical process for you to get to the point of saying, oh, this is a boundary, and I'm expressing it against this exact person in my life.
Yeah, yeah, how perfect. Again, just, you know, I was like, oh, wow, this just became so clear to me. I was hanging out with him, and I was so miserable because I wanted a dad that was different and doing, like, teaching me different things than what he was embodying and showing me in that moment. And I just said nothing. I just reflected his passivity and weakness. And I had to like conjure the ability to step up despite myself and say, no, this is not, no. And it was painful, and I didn't want to hurt him. And I wanted to, you know, not wanting to hurt him was the thing too. It's like when I was a kid, I saw his pain. I saw his suffering and his weakness. And as a kid, I was like, I wanted to love my dad. You know, I wanted him to feel okay. And I was placed in that adult role to take care of him when he was supposed to be taking care of me. And then he bounced. And so he really wasn't taking care of me.
How old were you when he left?
Four. About four. So then I saw that playing out again. Like, I was like, oh, you know, poor dad. Like, I don't want to hurt him. And I'm like, no, fuck this. Like, I want a fucking father to stand up and protect me. And if he's not going to do it, I'm going to do it. I'm going to be the father. I'm going to be the man that takes care of not only myself, but the world and my children, and serve the archetype that I didn't have and the world doesn't have too much in this, you know, modern culture.
So there's a couple of threads around masculinity that are kind of coming together in this moment. This idea of this risk-taking, performative version of masculinity, maybe an element of womanizing, maybe an element of drug use or whatever, there's a sort of like a risk-taking piece. This absent father who didn't demonstrate like a model of what it means to be a man. And then there's another piece, which is the love of the mother and the sort of allowance of the mother. And also, I think, the nice guy. So for me, I had a strong mother who taught me to be a nice guy. Yeah. So it was important not to be a dangerous man.
Yes.
But at the same time, there's vital energy in me that wants to express certain kind of energies of masculinity that because I'm so afraid, particularly in our modern cultural context, I'm so afraid of being a bad guy that I have to find different avenues. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was a lot of like drug use and risk-taking with my own body. So like, I'm not going to hurt anybody else. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be dangerous. I'm super nice. And I'm also like desperately reckless.
Yep.
It sounds like maybe you had some of that kind of mixture in your own experience.
Totally. Yeah. You know, God bless the feminists, but in many ways they emasculated men. You know, they emasculated us to the point of ineptitude. And sure, we were safe, but you know, that masculinity not being cultivated in a positive way ends up coming out in a dark masculine way, in a subtle way, in a repressed way. You know, it's like one of those water balloons. You squeeze it in one side and then that energy pops out in another. So, and that's all unconscious. So we're not even aware of it. We can't even own it. So yeah, I certainly had that same experience, definitely raised by very strong-willed, single mother, feminist. And I always thought I was a feminist and I didn't realize how much destructiveness I was actually enacting in the world unconsciously and, you know, mindlessly.
Well, it's almost like the way we become nice guys is to somehow surgically remove aspects of masculinity that are, you know, you would say toxic. But what's weird about that is that that energy is in our bodies. So if we have the proper cultural context, a village, strong male role models, then we can channel that energy into its right relation. So for example, the warrior setting a noble boundary, using anger to set that boundary.
Sure.
Whereas when we're raised to be nice guys, it's like, well, there's no anger allowed at all. You can't be angry. That's dangerous. So the anger has to go somewhere. And like you say with the water balloon, where does that anger go? You know, in many cases, in my case, pornography, like my relationship to my internal sexual world was a lot of where my masculine anger went. But it goes somewhere, risk-taking, craziness. And we're at such a poverty culturally of a container that holds the proper expression of different energies, particularly as men, and particularly some of these energies that have been so destructive in the past, like the male anger.
And I totally understand why women culturally, you know, pushed back against that toxic expression of masculine, the destructive masculine from back in the day, you know, but I think it's being corrected now. You know, there's a grand correction. And, you know, I'll give you an example of one way that I was not able to access my strong, powerful, dangerous, albeit, but still, you know, constructive masculine was with, you know, with my female friends and lovers, people that I, you know, was close to. I would let them, like, for example, if they're at my house late at a party or whatever, and it's like late and they're going to go get on the train at 2 a.m, I wouldn't even walk them to the train because I didn't want to be perceived as like acting like the chivalry. I couldn't be chivalrous because I didn't want them to think I was, didn't respect their ability to take care of themselves. Because my mom taught me, she's like, I'm strong. I take care of myself. I don't need men. I don't need men. I didn't need your father. You know, she pushed him away. And because she had all the men in her life that were, you know, disappointing or destructive at worst. And so she's like, fuck this. Like, just don't need those men. I'm going to just take care of myself. So I always believe, feminism means that women can take care of themselves. Don't open the door for them because they're going to do it themselves. They can also make as much money as you. So let them make money. Don't pay for them. You know, like the type of things that you want to do as a man, like my instinct is I want to take care. I want to protect. I want to pay. I want to, you know, support you as a woman. And I never let myself do that because I didn't want to be insulting. And it was just like, and we need strong, dangerous protectors to go out and protect women from those truly dangerous, dark masculine expressions of men out there. And so I choose to become more dangerous and to cultivate the skills so that when I am in a situation, I can stand up and use that energy to protect women, you know, direct it in the appropriate places.
And this is why I find the archetypal lens so helpful for masculinity, because so much of the world is about this oppositional construction of things. I'm this man because my dad was that man. Don't walk a woman to the train because then you're going to give her the impression that you don't believe in her sovereignty or her own power. It's everything is so reactive and defined by the negation of something else. But what I love about the archetypes is that they give us something to aspire to be, and they give us something to talk about and give us something to kind of, like, the warrior archetype isn't a particular, it's not a general, it doesn't even need to be someone related to like fighting in that way. But you can look at the warrior stands for something. And you have to have fortitude to stand for something. You have to have the ability to face danger. And the ability to face danger, I believe, comes from facing the danger in yourself, knowing that it's actually real, being a good steward of it, and then being able to face the world. Because if you're simply like, oh, I'm just nice, I'm like cool, I like take risks, I'm scrappy, I'm artistic, but I'm ultimately a nice guy, then that nice guy actually can't fully face the danger of the world and will potentially shirk that duty.
Agreed. Let's continue. We went on a tangent from Shot in the Dark at 20, and then again, my life playing out perfectly, you know, reflective of my karmic path in the world. So yeah, then it leads to Entourage, where I end up becoming the archetype for modern culture that represents that, that immature masculine, you know, pure Eternus.
How much did your actual life reflect what was presented on Entourage at that time or later?
Yeah, so, I mean, listen, you start to become the things that you practice, right? And you start to get good at that. You know, as we were talking about before, first it's a projection, you're kind of awkward at it, you're stumbling through a weird costume, and then it starts to become familiar, then it becomes you. It's amazing what a costume will do, especially in acting. You know, if you want to play a cowboy, don't play a cowboy. Just put on a cowboy outfit, like put on some boots and a hat and jump on a horse. Suddenly, you become a cowboy real quick.
I have become a cowboy myself, so I know that you're right. And it's very fun to become a cowboy, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, with regards to the Entourage character and that lifestyle is... That was certainly within my range, you know. I'm because I was, you know, I hadn't grown up yet. I was still quite immature and still in indulging in those kinds of ways. But the particular, what do you call it? The sort of that particular version, that brand, the Entourage brand identity was so foreign from me. I was a hipster from Brooklyn making independent films on my video camera, you know, that looked like they cost $10. Like that, I was just like a pure artist in many ways. And then I had to play this Hollywood guy with lots of money and lots of access and all that stuff. So it was a version of myself, but it was still new. And I took a crash course on how to be a celebrity with Mark Wahlberg when he took us all out to Vegas when we first started the show. And I just observed him, and that was sort of like, oh, wow, I see how this works. And now let me conjure my version, like that expression within me. And then over the years, I got better and better at it. And then because it paralleled my real life, because as the show became popular, I became famous myself, then I was able to practice not on the show, but actually in real life too. So the more swag you get, the more photographs get taken of you, the more oogling there is of fans. Once you get your first stalker, you know, it's like then...
That first stalker, that's when you know you've made it.
You start cutting your teeth and then you're like, oh, wow, yeah, like I am this. Or at least I'm playing it so well that it feels... natural. And the reward mechanism is so strong. The whole world was cheering me on. Be that guy. Be that guy. You know, we'll love you more. We'll pay you more, you know, if you are that. And it was also my job. I was contracted to play that role. So to resist was just not an option. So I had to, you know, I fall more and more in line with that archetype.
Well, and this was prior to social media and Instagram culture. And now we've really democratized that experience of believing that you're famous in a certain way. So you have an Instagram influencer who is traveling the world doing this thing and getting, you know, they're getting the free stuff shipped to them that then they promote. So it's, you know, maybe 20, 30 years ago, there were, I mean, and certainly not at the level that you were at, but there are much less people who are having a lifestyle like that. I think today, it's just building on itself and kind of like mushrooming out, and people are chasing. And it's so, now we have like clear metrics. You have this many followers on this platform. You have this much engagement. You gotta bump it up and then you get the more reward. And it's, I think a lot of people listening have some version of that that they experience in their lives. Mm-hmm. And it must have been for you, as I think this is for all of us, a lonely experience, right? Did you feel lonely within it?
Well, certainly, yeah, because I was telling a finite story, you know, the finite game of I'm going to win this and I'm going to have all the things and I'm going to be the hero of everything, you know, as opposed to, you know, reorienting yourself to a story of higher purpose or a more spiritual pursuit, which is more infinite and it's more communal and it's more in service of and in connection with each other and nature, as opposed to ego and, you know, what role you're going to play and how you're going to look in that shoot and what everyone's going to think, you know, all that stuff in, you know, the superficial commercial world of capitalism and, you know, just linear systems of exploitation. So really, yeah, lonely because it was just all about me. And so therefore the relationships that I was cultivating, because I wasn't feeding them and I was only feeding myself and using people around me, and I'm being dramatic a little bit. I mean, I was a nice guy, but unconsciously I was the most important person in my world. So every relationship had to serve me on some level. Otherwise, I wasn't present for it. And so people would leave when there's no reciprocity, when it's not a mutual exchange, people leave. Or when you're just all about you, people will reject you. And as I got older, I realized, I was like, where are my real friends? Where's that real? And it's because I was in this narcissistic head trip for too long.
Well, and we've spoken about how this transition point in your life, part of it was being aware of the people you'd surrounded yourself with. And so again, that kind of follows the path. Like your show was Entourage. And then you found yourself in a place where your entourage, your people, who you were surrounded with, and how they were then kind of feeding you to feed them, a kind of, you know, perhaps a kind of mutual exploitation. And as you've said, nice people, like nobody's meaning to harm anyone, or at least most people not meaning to harm people, but like the system is so structured to kind of like this sort of taking space. So it seems like you got to a place where you recognized that this was just not working and it wasn't feeding you.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like a light bulb that went out and was like, oh, wow, I need to change my life. No, it was more like a light bulb got shattered. My girlfriend of 4 years dumped me essentially, and then created a shock wave throughout my whole awareness that I was like, oh wow, like how could this girl that I love so much that knows me better than anyone could leave me when I'm winning? You know, the Charlie Sheen.
You have all the things.
I'm winning, you know, that was such a funny moment, because he was so far up his ass when he was like, I'm winning, when everybody around him was suffering. It was like, see? He could use a personal transformation into adult masculinity. But anyway, I digress. I recognized, because I had such a loss, it was so powerful that I needed to start making some changes and look at myself.
Heartbreak is purifying in that way, and can be one of the most potent tools to initiate a kind of period in the underworld that I think is actually really important for men in the modern in the modern climate. We spoke about Iron John, and in Iron John, which is a book by Robert Bly, part of the Mythopoetic Men's Movement, that uses the myth of Iron John as a way of understanding kind of the progression of mature masculinity. He talks about in that book the Trail of Ashes, that there's some, there comes a time, and it's often, you know, as it was in your case, sort of and late 30s, early 40s, and in the Trail of Ashes, he talks about how there's this time that we realize that our fire isn't just burning so brightly, that there's more ashes, that these that we're not ingesting the bigger logs in the fire of our lives. There's a awakening to mortality. And often it's triggered by a big loss where you're like, wait a minute, this is not sustainable. This isn't working. This thing that was so important in my life is suddenly gone, and I can't control it. There's sudden loss of control that takes us into this period of the underworld, which can be so sacred to be in that place. Horrible, devastating, painful, but deeply sacred. And this occurred only a couple of years ago for you, that you went into this period.
Yeah, about 2.5 years ago now. Maybe longer, 2.5. Yeah. It took about 2 years of complete, absolute suffering. Painful, painful process. Yeah. A lot of hard work and consistent commitment, recommitting to the work, even though, man, you just want a break. I want relief. And it's that pull towards like not feeling, like being given, you know, the suckling of your mother's breast and like comfort of your mommy is what you crave as like that young, immature man. You know, you're just like, you just want comfort. You want relief.
From the feminine especially, I think.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the girlfriend is gone and it's like, give me that soft safety. Let me lay my head with someone who loves me unconditionally so I can so I can just be, you know, in that womb-like embryonic place.
Exactly. And the unconditional part is like, no matter how treacherous and malevolent I am, accept me and love me, as opposed to the masculine energy, which is discernment, right and wrong, like, no. You know, you have to conjure a better version of yourself, a better expression of your masculine. And that hurts because it means you have to let go of all the immediate gratification and confirmation of your safety and your power. You give it up and get on your knees and humble yourself to something bigger and really truly learn how to shape your strength and your self-reliance and grow, literally conjure the ability to stand on your own despite how, you know, like horribly painful life can be and how scary and sad and upsetting, and be able to stand and withstand all of that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how you were able to stand in that moment, because I feel like this is going to be really helpful for people listening to this podcast. Definitely young men, also women too. And I think that as we're talking about, just to flag this, as we're talking about masculinity and the journey of men, I think that it's helpful in our cultural context to look at this gender lens, particularly for the way that men are suffering. But this is by no means an entirely gendered path.
I think, you know, in this, like these days, people are very sensitive. There's a very uncomfortable conversation around gender identity, masculine, feminine polarity, because of, you know, people wanting to have an authentic expression of their unique selves perfectly as they are without having to conform to those two poles. So you just want to be sensitive to that. So we respect all people for all of their expressions, masculine, feminine, or otherwise. It's just the masculine, feminine archetypes, I think, are very helpful and provide a lot of guidance.
Well, and I think gender does play a role in maturation in a certain way. I mean, for women, there's a rite of passage that is childbirth, that is undeniable. Like, it's a physiological, absolute transformation. Mm-hmm. And not to say that women don't go through rites of passage without childbirth, but there's culturally and biologically that's present. And for men, in many traditional societies, there have been specific rites of passage for men. So when I think about this path of becoming a man, I find the gender lens to be helpful in the idea of the boy that then becomes a man, because so much of our culture is steeped in the idea of the man who is a man because he's not a woman. Let me reject my feminine characteristics, that which I consider the feminine in me, and that will make me the man I want to be. But really, it's about the man who's not a boy rather than the man who's not a woman.
Yeah. 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 Oh, yeah. I'm very in touch with my feminine. that I don't have that problem, you know. So I certainly am not rejecting my feminine attributes. I'm just maybe, you know, hoping to cultivate what I'm naturally predisposed to be, which is more masculine, and so that I and you know, in fact, in many ways, I'm learning to be a protector, be a little bit dangerous, so that I can be a protector. Because the world is dangerous, and not just for women in my lives, but also for my own feminine. I want to protect myself. Yeah.
Protecting our own feminine as men is a really interesting way of experiencing the world, I think.
Yeah, I realized that I was exploiting the parts of me that were feminine for like wealth and fame and status, you know, my creativity, my ability to, you know, be in touch with the magic of creation itself. I mean, that's what feminine is, right? Women can literally conjure life, create life. Life passes through them in childbirth, but it's also not babies, but also the creative process itself of taking the infinite range of what's possible and bringing in, you know, newness into our lives. And yeah, for a while I was just exploiting that aspect of myself in Hollywood, prostituting myself out to make money and, you know, get attention. And now, as a more divine masculine protector, I'm like, fuck that. I'm not going to do that to myself anymore.
I love this idea of understanding these sort of polarities within ourselves and letting the masculine hold that role. I want to circle back to a moment ago. I wanted to offer you the opportunity to open source some of your journey, because that particular trail of ashes, that kind of devastation, that barren, impoverished landscape that we find ourselves in our lives, there are tools, there are things that can help. One that I know has been really important to you is embodiment. What sort of techniques and tools did you use during that transition period to help you get through it?
Yeah. I mean, I was essentially having an out-of-body experience for 30 years of my life, in that I was not in my body. I was in a fantasy, in my head, in my intellect, in my ego, in my pleasure, in my, you know, the pursuit of numbing agents, and not being able to really settle into what my body was feeling. And the body being a very complex set of receivers and senses that can actually take information from the world in all different ways and process it through, you know, different mechanisms. But it's not just sight and touch, but it's intuition. And so in not allowing myself to feel pain, feel the things that the traumas from my childhood, I was missing a whole piece of the story, a whole bunch of information that would have helped me and does now help me make more discerning choices, make more accurate choices based on what is, not what's just I'm projecting or what I want to be in my head, in my ego, but like what actually is. And that's a reality blast, which is hard and painful, but so important if you actually want to make accurate, honest choices. So did that become too abstract?
No, not at all. And I think that to embody the conversation about embodiment, you know, your foot falls asleep. When you stand up, that pain is wild. As you began to rediscover your interoception, as you began to physically feel the information coming in your body, did it come through as a lot of overwhelming pain for you?
Oh, yeah. I have a mentor that we both know, Alana Mehta, and she was instrumental in helping me come back and re-enter my body. And she's a somatic practitioner, you know, expert in, you know, masculine, feminine polarities and sexuality and embodiment, I'd say. And, you know, just a really talented facilitator, willing to go to really challenging places in order to give me the ability to grow in those ways.
You know, and one thing I will flag about her is she has humor too in it. I really like that about her. There's a sweetness and a humor, and I've had moments with her as a colleague. I haven't had her as a sort of a facilitator in my own life, but in terms of giving talks, or we did a naked talk at Burning Man together once.
Oh yeah.
It was called the Penis and Vagina Dialogues. But I've come to her with, you know, oh, woe is me. And she's like, yeah, but is woe you? Really? Like, you know, she's got a kind of soft humor that I think creates a levity and playfulness, which is important when there's a lot of pain moving through the body in an experience like you've described. Mm-hmm. And the trick is to let the energy move through the body without letting your stories grab onto it and start doing stuff. So one of the ways of getting out of the story is that humor and is that kind of trickster energy. And I think she does embody that well.
Absolutely. You know, and her willingness to go there as well and be unabashed in her generosity to you know, really be there and hold space for me. And I mean, I'm sure I only have the experience that I've had, but I'm sure, you know, that's why she's been so successful and she does that for people. But she just instinctively knew that I was ready, I guess, because I was doing some work with her. I was practicing celibacy and she was sort of holding a container for me to...
How long did you do the celibacy, and did that include not masturbating?
So I've done two during my transformation, my 2-year catabasis. One was about 3 months. That was my first one. And there was masturbation in that. And then the second one I did was, it ended up being 5 months or so. And I was practicing semen retention during that one. Whew, that was hard. that was really challenging.
There's a lot. The semen retention thing is a really interesting portal for men, because that gratification, pornography, such a way to escape from feeling. Fantasy, you can have anything you want on the internet. You can have anything you want in your own mind. And if you've played your cards right, you can have a lot of what you want in the world, potentially. So that gratification. Mm. And then the actual experience of the little death, the petit mont of like, that is a death of our energy when we totally. When we ejaculate. So it's a high noble road to do a long period of that kind of container. Did that feel like it changed things in your body? That particular part of your transition, did that feel particularly potent in an embodiment?
Yeah, I mean, 1,000%. I mean, it's a practice that really challenges my instinct to just take the easy road or to, you know, it's like the lazy part of myself that just wants to seek immediate gratification and pleasure versus the long game. You know, the 2 marshmallows.
Oh, yeah, 30 the marshmallow
minutes later.
Experiment. Yeah.
Right. So like definitely I would have taken the marshmallow, the immediate marshmallow, if I was in that study, versus waiting for, you know, a future better, you know, better choice.
When you're building a muscle too, when you're in that, the waves of that underworld experience, and you have to feel them, and you can't cry, someone come and take this away from you. You just can't, like when you get to the place that you were mm-hmm. at where you're just fully in it, you have to experience. Mm-hmm. And you're building a muscle, and you're building mm-hmm. this spiritual muscle of presence.
Yes. And the patience, again, back to patience, like the patience for future reward that isn't just immediately for you, and then the ability to hold and withstand the discomfort in the moment of not getting that immediate gratification for that long-term gain. And this very practice has become the way in which I connect to the divine and the infinite spiritual path, because I know that in this life, this whole life, my brief time here is just a moment for me to hold space for my children and my future self or the future incarnations, so that what I'm doing can actually benefit that reality in the future. So really giving myself in sacrifice to a bigger, greater, longer term, 10, 15 generations from now, longer term ideal. So that what I do now needs to serve that into the future.
You know, there's a lot of ways we talk about a healthy masculinity, a tender masculinity or a mature masculinity. I came across this idea of the deep masculine, which I found to be very compelling. And the deep masculine is the mountain. The deep masculine is a kind of stillness, a kind of, and it's so deep on like the exploration of the polarity that it's a kind of absolute stillness mm-hmm. that allows the absolute creativity of the feminine,
yeah.
the space to play. And so that if you take the polarity all the way, it's like Shiva Shakti, like all the way that there's this deep mountainous mm-hmm. masculine. And when we stop like wriggling and trying to get away and squirming, like get this out, when we mm-hmm. finally stop, we can tap into that deep stillness. Mm-hmm. Was there a period where you felt like, okay, like I've balanced on the wave now, like I can be here for this? Was there a time that came together for you?
Well, then I started witnessing how those practices were serving me. Right at first, I like, couldn't see it. Like, what's the point of this? This sucks. It hurts. You know, it's. I just want to like splooge. You know, yeah. And because that's, I trained myself to that immediate gratification for so long. You know, it's like, you know, and so it took a while for me to stop wiggling.
I'm like it's like a worm on a hook.
Yeah, exactly. This to stop the agitation, and to be still enough to start to witness what my body's telling me and what I'm experiencing, so that I could start making certain choices. And then when I started realizing and seeing that the choices I was making were having positive results, versus before when I would just make whatever immediate choice I could to feel less, and you know, realizing that there was like immediate karma that I started to experience, and like, okay, now I'm really starting to get somewhere. And that process actually took me to a place where I could settle, breathe, become steady and reliable enough that I could actually go and reach out to my ex-girlfriend who dumped me and say, I'm ready now to give and serve you in all your feminine glory in ways I couldn't before. And that patience, what took like another 6 months for me to actually be able to win my girlfriend back. So yeah, I mean, it was definitely challenging, but it took that amount of patience and consistency over time to be able to actually win my queen.
And this is not available to the quote nice guy. The nice guy is like, be nice, do the right thing, and you'll get what you want. And what you want is really important, so be nice and get what you want. It's a little bit like, that's kind of this sort of somewhat flaccid way of being in the world that I think is what a lot of young men have been patterned to. This is like, be still, feel, mm-hmm. be present, observe, see how your actions can positively benefit the world around you. Get into that virtuous cycle where that fuels you. It starts to fuel that fire, that heroic fire, mm-hmm. and then it starts to build. And then in your case, it allowed you to reconnect with your partner. And it also turned into a clear path of service for you. Mm-hmm. And so I want to talk a bit about that.
Yeah, and by the way, you need that buildup of energy. You need that chi in order to achieve those higher aspirations, those loftier goals. And so in the semen retention practice, I was able to cultivate that energy and build up enough chi within me to go do the things that are very hard. You know, they're harder than I've ever done before. To face like the most challenging things in my life that I would always avoid or take the easy way out or let someone else do. Mom. And so that discipline and practice is just, it's not the goal itself. It's just giving you the capacity to take on more and do harder shit.
Well, let's talk about the goal itself. We are here in Austin. We are on this property, which is named after the Japanese art of taking broken pieces and mending them with gold thread. What is the word for that?
Kintsugi.
Kintsugi.
Kintsugi, yeah.
Which is the name of this property. Mm-hmm. And tell me how you are threading gold through broken pieces in your work now.
Yeah. Well, it's very symbolic. My partner and I, Jordan, we were together and then we broke up. We were broken into pieces and then we came back together. And now we are mended with gold, with our love. So very symbolic for us personally, but also, you know, we see it as, you know, holding together chosen family and bringing together people, disparate people, and connecting them with, you know, the gold of like, you know, love and shared space. So on a symbolic realm, it works perfectly. Also, you know, looking to take some of the old farming practices, you know, maybe that were more chemical based and a little bit more destructive to the land, and heal this earth, heal this part of the earth, this little plot of land as well. Yeah, so we are very much mending and bringing together community. And our goal is to have a number of people living here on the land with us in a sort of conscious cul-de-sac, if you will. And then helping to keep the land in its full potential glory.
Well, and often when you're conceptualizing maybe an intentional community, there can get a lot of ego in that conceptualization. It's like, I will be the hero who does this thing. Mm-hmm. I'll be the hero who mends the earth. But the reality is not very heroic, right? The reality is like, you're not just playing the role of rancher. You actually are responsible for tractors and responsible for, you know, animals and responsible ultimately for people. And one of the things that I found most helpful in King, Warrior, Magician, Lover is in the archetype of the king. Mm. The king orders his own house so that order will ripple out throughout the realm. And there's a style of leadership in that model that's about doing your work and doing humble work that then models the work that you want to see. And that actually the king is not about conquering. That's the tyrant. Mm-hmm. And the king is not lording over. And the king is also not weak. The king must be very strong. Mm-hmm. So you go through this trail of ashes as you've gone through. You go through this underworld experience to build this strength, to build this fortitude. And then there's that last little piece of leading with humility. And with that in mind, I'd like to ask you this question. Why do you like doing dishes?
Oh, man. Yeah, I do dishes. Well, it's I think, symbolically, like sort of perfectly distilled representation of what it means to clean up, to show up, to clean up, and to serve. So I do believe that we need to take full responsibility of our space, you know, and what we interact with in the world. And the dishes are every day, they're constant. And so to have that practice of doing the dishes and not waiting, oh, I'll do them in the morning, that's no. You do them before you go to bed. You make sure they're done, because it's just, if you can develop that discipline, it ripples out to all other aspects of your life. So it's fundamental to me. It's connected to our sustenance, our food, the way we eat, and then cleanliness and order, like creating order in your life. There's plenty of chaos already, you know, and I think we serve each other by cleaning up a little bit and making things nice and creating a bit of order so that we can have room to breathe and room to think of loftier things, you know, bigger things.
Well, and the prince has everything taken care of for him.
Oh, man, I was there.
Vinny Chase does not drive.
No.
Right? like it was, you know, almost cartoonishly princely that way. And never would do a dish.
No.
You know? And you've spoken about wanting people to come to this land, to participate in this land, have a reciprocal relationship with this land, and actually build.
Yeah.
Rather than, let me hire someone, have them come on the land, have no real connection with them in that kind of like I-it in the Martin Buber sort of framework, the I-it transactional relationship versus the I-thou relationship of like, let's raise a barn.
Yes, 100%. You know, and it's because I think, you know, culturally speaking, we found ourselves going down sort of a wrong turn in civilization. You know, we're all fragmented, family structures are broken apart and everything's outsourced and we don't actually get to do anything ourselves. We don't have any survival skills, you know. And so in order to be trustworthy, you have to have the skills and the capacity to actually do the thing and to be reliable. So when I invite people onto this land and we're living in harmony or living in community rather, I want to be able to trust that my neighbors can, you know, help when something goes wrong and that we don't need to like make a bunch of money to outsource that effort. And then also the very act of doing something with your neighbors creates that bond, that community, and that sense of satisfaction and mutuality, you know, reciprocity. So yeah, I certainly don't want people coming here and just like buying into this experience. And also it's connected to money. And money wants you to exploit. There's an exploitation associated with money. And so the last thing I want to do when people come here is first thing, you know, exploit them and make money off of them. So everything here will be totally open source, transparent, all budgets, all finances will be completely transparent and above board so that everybody can pay into the system through, you know, whatever's fair, whatever's truly fair and honest about it. So this is not a business. This is a lifestyle and a community. And ultimately our biggest shareholder is the land. So this will be a trust that us community members will have the opportunity to support and to serve the land, serve nature over time. So ultimately, hopefully, whatever system we create here will last beyond our lives and will continue to, you know, future generations.
Constructing an intentional community is notoriously difficult.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what sort of models have you been looking at, or what have you been reading? What's been informing? Because you're in a great place where you're like at the foundation of this new venture. You have a lovely piece of land. You already have community members. You have people that you admire. So you've got all the raw materials here. So it's kind of like it's yours to, or the community's to navigate that. Mm-hmm. What are you modeling off of?
Yeah, so there's, you know, several different models, and I've been talking to a lot of people who are doing similar things and accumulating a lot of documents, legal documents. We haven't set that in stone yet, and that's where patience comes in for us. You know, we're not looking to rush this process. We know that this is our lives into the foreseeable future. I imagine being gray here one day. And so just giving ourselves permission to take our time, you know, live in the cadence of nature and not have to rush it, knowing that eventually when other people come into the mix, that they will also have their perspectives. And so there's a letting go and a surrender ultimately to the community and what we're, you know, what decisions we make together. So I want to definitely be able to honor sort of open source collective decision making. But so in terms of hard models that we're utilizing, I don't have that. I just imagine some sort of trust in which the land becomes sort of the primary shareholder and we serve the land.
And I think our mutual friend Jamie Wheel's ideas of ethical cults might come in handy.
Ethical.
Yeah, trying to, you know, just the logistics of bringing people together is a lot to hold. And coming back to the king archetype is, you know, we do our own work so that we can show up in community. We clean our own vessels so that we don't end up taking the one ring of power that is the community leadership with all of the all of that attention that we were talking about, all of that adoration that there's a part of us that really craves. We gotta stay firm in that when taking on these kind of ventures.
Yeah, I'd been wanting to do some sort of community for probably 20 years. I'm so glad I didn't do it when I was still in my Prince PR Eternus stage, because that would have been a disaster.
It would have been puerile. It's by its very nature. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you've earned it in that you passed through an important portal. And I think that that's really encouraging for people who see something like that on the horizon, who may be in it now. I mean, with COVID, a lot of us were triggered into the underworld through the COVID experience. Yeah. Like there was a global rite of passage.
Absolutely.
That has been happened through that. So, you know, I think it's encouraging to listen to you having gone through a transition, and obviously transformation never ends and we continue to grow and change, so it isn't so clean, but you've come to a place where you've reconnected with your erstwhile beloved. You have, and now beloved again, you separated and came back together, and in the way that romantic stories feel so great when they do that.
Oh yeah.
And you've found this piece of land and it is green and wet and alive. So you're in a place now where you've earned it. And if you're able to maintain that stillness that you found, that embodiment that you found, and you'll get tested because that's how it works. But as you are able to maintain that, I think that will bring so much flourishing to this place.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for that recap. It sounds like we're on the right path.
Well, it'd be interesting to check in and see, because, you know, much like a relationship, like a romantic relationship, you know, you will get triggered in your vulnerable places, no doubt.
Yeah. And the land is volatile. There is a lot going on.
Yeah, we just had a hurricane, didn't we?
It's like a tornado touchdown not too far from here. And every day you wake up and there's something new to do. You know, something on the land that needs tending to. You know, we have a motto here: get to have to. It's like you get to, but you have to also. It's like, this is also work.
Think about it like you get to, but by the way, you have to.
Right. Yeah. And it's not even summer yet. So we're looking forward to just getting to know the land and letting the land speak to us and getting into the natural flow of those cycles of nature.
Well, and it sounds like this land will be your next great teacher, you know, as you say, with the seasons and the cycles and the different ways that it challenges you. So yeah, you've positioned yourself well, I think, to keep this growth and change. And do you think that you'll do another version of that documentary you did with your father? Do you feel like you'll return to that particular motif in your life, or does that feel at rest to you?
So I've made two very personal documentaries. One, Shot in the Dark. The second one was Teenage Paparazzo, which I think you'd also enjoy. That's Hall of Mirrors. My rise to fame by playing a famous person in a culture that was obsessed with fame. And then turning the cameras on a paparazzi kid. And then together, he's 13, together we sort of pull back the curtain and deconstruct celebrity obsession.
This is a real 13-year-old paparazzi kid?
Yeah, documentary, all real. Yeah. And so that was very, very, very much sort of the second installment of what I see as a trilogy, because first one is, I don't need a father. What is father? I'm my own man. Then let me play in the world of Princeton and, you know, media and indulgence and fame and commercialism, you know, materialism, and get intellectual about everything, like really postmodern and really meta and cute. Very cute. Like, let me just play with all of the levers and create this story and explore. And then there really does need to be the third installment, I think, which is, from my perspective now, you know, much more grounded, hopefully more mature storytelling perspective.
Maybe there's your own experience of fatherhood might be a threshold point for that kind of storytelling.
I love that plot line.
Yeah, right? I mean, because that's what's likely coming next for you, I'd imagine, is getting your own shot at trying not to cause harm to a small impressionable being.
Oh, yeah, good luck with that, I guess.
Yeah, we all are harmed. We all harm. We all kind of, that's the human experience.
Oh!
You weaken the karmic chains by doing your own work and then being able to model that to your kids. Yeah. As a non-parent, I believe, is the case. I guess it's a lot more complicated in reality.
Right. Well, you're just, everything's a trade-off, right? You're just moving. You're in balance, hopefully, you know, meandering, moving. Not that you're trying to solve, you know, some karmic thing. You're just slowly nudging life into a positive direction.
You're just turning your leaves towards the light.
There you go.
Which we learn from the trees.
Yeah, that's
just
right.
Just patiently turn your leaves towards the light.
Absolutely.
Adrian, it's been such a pleasure to chat with you about these important male topics.
Yes,
this
sir.
This was quite a masculinity exploration today that was, and frankly, quite nourishing for my own, you know, perennial trails of ashes that I wander through. And so just listening to your reflection, and I found it very inspiring for me personally. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to have had this conversation with you as well. And I'm encouraged by how many young men are starting to awaken. And it feels encouraging to me to have like the camaraderie in that, and to feel that we can support each other and protect each other and take care of each other and also hold each other accountable. So thank you.
And I think that the patriarchal debts of our gender represent portals for our stepping up. You know, the obstacle is the way.
Yeah.
The heritage of toxic masculinity does give us this opportunity to reframe and redefine what it means to be a man. And there's an enormous creative potential in that. And so for you, doing something like this where you're like, I'm dedicating to the land. creating a trust with the land stewardship foremost. I'm doing the dishes. Like, you're repatterning the masculine in real time. And we get to have a little podcast about it. And I think a lot of people listening are like, oh, perhaps I shall do the dishes today.
Yeah. Good. Thanks, Ben.
My pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you like the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.